You're listening to Big Ideas, the only regularly scheduled television program in North America devoted to the art of the lecture and the importance of ideas in public life. It is broadcast on TVO every Saturday and Sunday at 4 p.m. For more information on our program, go to our website at tvo.org/bigideas.
Ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, dear friends, I am very, very honored to be here with you this evening and to continue the lectures which I began yesterday evening. These lectures, ladies and gentlemen, are about theatrical oratory in trials. And I examine three memorable speeches that occurred in these trials, and I try to see them in their particular historical and courtroom contexts. Drawing on a very substantial literature that links trials to theater, I want to look at these addresses not only as part of a legal process, but also as literature, expositions that can and should be appreciated the way one would passages from novels or short stories or even poetry. My choices come from what I call great trials, by which I mean trials about issues of importance to society and in which there is an understood reference that refer to an audience outside the courtroom. My two cases involve great moments, by which I mean moments when the participants seem to realize the wider significance of what they are saying, and they seem to elevate their rhetoric beyond the immediate issues at stake and speak in a voice that transcends the language of the law. Last time, I discussed Oscar Wilde on trial in the Old Bailey in London in 1895, and now I want to turn to two more examples: the example of Nikolai Bukharin in Moscow in 1938, and then the opening moments of the trial of the major German war criminals at Nuremberg in November 1945. So let me begin with Bukharin. This trial is one of the Moscow trials, the third in three famous show trials, which occurred at the height of Stalin's terror between 1936 and 1938. This is probably the most famous of the Soviet show trials, which were themselves a special hallmark of the Soviet era. Officially, the trial was known by the term the trial of the anti-Soviet bloc of Wrights and Trotskyites, using the formula that the Soviets used themselves. There were 21 defendants, all of whom came from the elite of the Communist Party and rulers of the Soviet Union, the leading member of whom was Nikolai Bukharin, aged 49 and unquestionably a communist aristocrat, by which I mean that he was there from the beginning, a comrade of Lenin, former editor of Pravda, former editor of Izvestia, someone who had been a member of the original Politburo of the Soviet Union. In other words, someone who had all of the credentials and prestige of a founder of the USSR. And this great aristocrat faced in 1938 the following indictment, that, quote, having on the instructions of the intelligence services of foreign states hostile to the Soviet Union, he formed a conspiratorial group named the Bloc of Wrights and Trotskyites with the object of espionage on behalf of foreign states. These defendants were accused of, and I quote again, wrecking diversionist and terrorist activities, undermining the military power of the USSR with the object of overthrowing the socialist, social, and state system existing in the USSR and of restoring capitalism, restoring the power of the bourgeoisie, unquote. And there were even additional allegations that Bukharin, together with the others, had conspired to kill the Leningrad party chief, Sergei Kirov, and even Lenin himself. So politically, one cannot imagine any accusations more grave than that. These trials and these accusations were, of course, driven by Stalin himself and by his own paranoid fantasies. Stalin was even present, as we now know, for some of the sessions in the courtroom. But at the back, he watched through a darkened room at one end of the courtroom behind a one-way mirror. The trial took place in the ornate October Hall of the Trade Union House, formerly the ballroom of the aristocratic Nobles Club, and before a three-judge panel. The chief prosecutor, you know his name, Andrei Vyshinsky, 54 years old, prosecutor general of the USSR. His tone was brutal and sometimes even vulgar. March 11th. The Trotskyites and Bukharinites, that is to say, the bloc of Rights and Trotskyites, the leading lights of which are now in the prisoner's dock, is not a political party, a political tendency, but a band of felonious criminals. And not simply felonious criminals, but of criminals who have sold themselves to the enemy intelligence services. Criminals whom even ordinary felons treat as the basest, the lowest, the most contemptible, the most depraved of the depraved. And calling for the death penalty to all of the accused, I quote, "Our whole country, from young to old, is awaiting and demanding one thing, the traitors and spies who were selling our country to the enemy must be shot like dirty dogs. Our people are demanding one thing, crush the accursed reptile. Time will pass. The graves of the hateful traitors will grow over with weeds and thistle. They will be covered with the eternal contempt of honest Soviet citizens, of the entire Soviet people. But over us, over our happy country, our sun will shine with its luminous rays as bright and as joyous as before. Over the road cleared of the last scum and filth of the past, we, our people, with our beloved leader and teacher, the great Stalin at our head, will march as before, onwards and onwards towards communism." Unquote. That was the tone, and that was the style of Andrei Vyshinsky. The accused had been in prison for about a year. There were rehearsals of the trial, at least its open session. There were threats against family. There was even occasional torture, though, so far as we know, not conducted against Bukharin. Now, how to interpret these strange and bizarre events? And I will concede that some of you present, especially the lawyers perhaps, will say that this isn't a trial at all. But it was a trial in the lexicon of the USSR at the time, and it was also called a trial elsewhere in the West, where observers were sent to watch this process. Everyone, let me say, observing this trial, recognized a link with theater. And the signature element of the theater of the Soviet show trials was, of course, the confession, which was an inescapable element of the dramaturgy. Here is the Princeton University specialist Robert Tucker, I quote, "The court proceedings of the show trials became literally a dramatic performance in which not only the judge and the prosecutor, but also the defendants played arranged parts.
just as actors do on the stage. The crux of the show trial is the confession. The defendant plays the leading part by confessing in vivid detail to heinous crimes allegedly committed by himself and others as part of a great conspiracy. Now, how should we interpret these trials? How should we understand them? Well, one obvious way of understanding them is as a theatrical projection of Stalin's own mental world. His paranoid fantasies, his lust for revenge against those whom he believed to be plotting against him, and perhaps as well his urge, his lust for complete, unopposed power. A related view is that the Great Purge trials were an attempt to prepare the party and the USSR for what was perceived as the coming war against fascism. Remember, this is 1938. This is the time of Hitler's march into Austria in the spring, the background to his pressure against Czechoslovakia. The Soviets are acutely aware of this, and Stalin may well have been brooding about his own need for complete, absolute, unopposed power facing this great challenge. It's a view. Many of these theories offering explanations of the Soviet show trials are variants on the theme, very much studied in the 1950s, of totalitarianism. This is part, often understood as part of the totalitarian project in the Soviet Union, and the trials are seen as efforts to strengthen the control of Stalin by inducing fear and by promoting permanent instability from which the leader would emerge as unchallenged. Now, one of the most famous of these interpretations goes deeper than these kinds of analysis, and I want to dwell on it just a moment. I think it's probably the most commonly articulated understanding of the Soviet show trial, and links in particular to Nikolai Bukharin, whose role I'm going to discuss in just a moment. The most famous of these perspectives, which I've just referred to, is that by the Hungarian Jewish novelist Arthur Koestler, writing in England his famous novel published in 1940, Darkness at Noon. Arthur Koestler had in mind Bukharin when he crafted his fictional character Rubashov, who is in very much Bukharin's position facing a show trial. Rubashov was persuaded in Koestler's novel to perform, and this is the tag, his last service to the party. His last service to the party was to confess the error of his ways. In this view, in Koestler's view, the defendants were in a strange way complicit in this drama. They were, in an odd way, willing actors in the play directed by Stalin. The key to this role is a faith in which they had in effect been raised, a faith, an unshakable faith in the rectitude of the party. They had a view of the party which held that it could do no wrong, and this view was so unshakable that even the defendants still believed in it. You think it's impossible? Well, listen to Rubashov, again from Koestler's novel, speaking to his interrogator. and I quote, "The party can never be mistaken. You and I can make a mistake, not the party. The party, comrade, is more than you and I and 1,000 others like you and I. The party is the embodiment of the revolutionary idea in history. History knows no scruples and no hesitation. Inert and unerring, she flows towards her goal. At every bend in her course, she leaves the mud which she carries and the corpses of the drowned. History knows her way. She makes no mistakes. He who has not absolute faith in history does not belong in the party's ranks." Unquote. Now, this is early in the novel, when Rubashov still considers himself, or is still considered, a member of the party. Later in the novel, another interrogator, a harder interrogator, tells Rubashov what he is supposed to do at a trial. And I quote, "Your task," that is Rubashov's task, "is simple. You have to set it yourself, to gild the right, to blacken the wrong. The policy of the opposition is wrong. Your task is therefore to make the opposition contemptible, to make the masses understand that opposition is a crime and that the leaders of the opposition are criminals. That is the simple language which the masses understand. If you will begin to talk of your complicated motives, you will only create confusion amongst them. Your task, citizen Rubashov," note, no longer comrade Rubashov, citizen Rubashov, "your task is to avoid awakening sympathy and pity. Sympathy and pity for the opposition are a danger to the country. Rubashov, I hope that you have understood the task that the party has set for you." Related to this, faith in the party is an understanding of communist morality that helped define the ethos of the elite of the Soviet system, based on almost religious principles in which belief in the rectitude of the party is a matter of personal faith. These trials featured confessions as a kind of religious exercise. And it's even been said by some interpreters that they derive their shape from the Orthodox tradition of public confession and penance, which was so different from the private nature of confession in the Christian West. But there is an alternative, and that view is that Bukharin, at least, was trying to send a message beyond the court, that he was conducting a kind of duel with Vyshinsky. He had been threatened. He had been bludgeoned. His family had been menaced. But nevertheless, in the course of the trial, he conducted this kind of oddly screened opposition to his tormentor through the use of, and this is an important term, Aesopian language. Aesopian language. This is named after the ancient Greek storyteller Aesop. You've heard of Aesop's fables. Well, this is Aesop's language, which is language designed to convey an innocent meaning to outsiders, but in which there is a key. There is a concealed meaning to informed members of a conspiracy or underground movement. This is a manner of speech that Russian revolutionaries had developed under the Tsars in public trials and otherwise facing the Tsarist police apparatus. The accused would try, while formally acceding to the authorities, they would try to signal and convey and send messages of resistance. And so the argument is that Bukharin is trying to do this, formally acceding to Vyshinsky, offering profuse confessions, while at the same time, through a sort of double talk, or through concealed language, or messages hidden in his speech, signaling his own resistance, his own opposition. A Bukharin biographer, Stephen Cohen, writes about this, and I quote, "Briefly stated, Bukharin's tactic would be to make sweeping confessions that he was politically responsible for everything, thereby at once saving his family and underlining his symbolic role, that is, as a criminal, while at the same time flatly denying or subtly disproving his complicity in actual crime. Bukharin was going on trial to testify before another higher court, the court of history and the future generation to which he had addressed his last words. Or as he said in the courtroom, world history is a world court of judgment and the only one that mattered. The result was a dazzling exhibition of double talk, evasion, code words, veiled illusions, exercises in logic, and stubborn denials." And ladies and gentlemen, the idea is that thereby, you see it, Bukharin is really speaking, well, to us. So let me now propose this to you by going through Bukharin's famous address to the court, his last speech in which he is, so it is argued, using Aesopian language, trying to convey underneath the confession and alongside the acknowledgement of his criminality a kind of hidden opposition to Vyshinsky and to the situation in which he finds himself. Bukharin began, and by the way, this is in another night session, on March 12, 1938, his last plea. This is the one when he is, if he is, speaking outside the courtroom and even possibly to ourselves, while at the same time facing the brutal constraint of the Stalinist show trial. It's for you to judge what is underway here as he begins, and I quote, "Citizen President and citizen judges," he began, "I fully agree with citizen the prosecutor," that's Vyshinsky, "regarding the significance of the trial at which were exposed our dastardly crimes, the crimes committed by the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites, one of whose leaders I was, and for all of the activities of which I bear responsibility. Bukharin pleaded guilty to the sum total of crimes committed by this counter-revolutionary organization." But at the same time, he then went on to dispute every particular fact that Vyshinsky had alleged. "Yes, I'm guilty of everything, but no, I didn't do this. No, I didn't do that." Bukharin reminded the court that he had been isolated. I quote, "I've been in prison for over a year, and I therefore do not know what is going on in the world. But judging from those fragments of real life that sometimes reached me by chance, I see, feel, and understand that the interests which we so criminally betrayed are entering a new phase of gigantic development and are now appearing in the international arena as a great and mighty factor of the international proletarian phase." Now, what's all that about? His confession. Quote, "In court, I admitted, and I still admit, my guilt in respect to the crimes which I committed and of which I was accused by citizen the state prosecutor at the end of the court investigation, and on the basis of the materials of the investigation in the possession of the prosecutor. I declared also in court, and I stress and I repeat it now, that I regard myself as politically responsible for the sum total of all of the crimes committed by the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites. I have merited the most severe punishment, and I agree with Citizen, the prosecutor, who several times repeated that I stand on the threshold of my hour of death. Bukharin insists that he's speaking freely. Make of it what one will. Repentance, by which he means confession, repentance is often attributed to diverse and absolutely absurd things like Tibetan powders and the like. I must say of myself that in prison, where I was confined for over a year, I worked, studied, and retained my clarity of mind. This will serve to refute by facts all fables and absurd counter-revolutionary tales. Hypnotism is suggested. But I conducted my own defense in the court from the legal standpoint too, oriented myself on the spot, argued with the state prosecutor, and anybody, even a man who has little experience in this branch of medicine, must admit that hypnotism of this kind is altogether impossible. I shall now speak of myself, of the reasons for my repentance. Of course, it must be admitted that incriminating evidence plays a very important part. For 3 months, I refused to say anything. Then I began to testify. Why? Because while in prison, I made a reevaluation of my entire past. Now, what does that mean? For when you ask yourself if you must die, what are you dying for? An absolute black vacuity suddenly arises before you with startling vividness. There was nothing to die for if one wanted to die unrepented. And on the contrary, everything positive that glistens in the Soviet Union acquires new dimension in a man's mind. This, in the end, disarmed me completely and led me to bend my knees before the party and the country. And when you ask yourself, very well, suppose you do not die. Suppose by some miracle you remain alive. Then what for? Isolated from everybody, an enemy of the people, in an inhuman position, completely isolated from everything that constitutes the essence of life. And at once the same reply arises. And at such moments, judges, everything personal, all the personal incrustation, all the rancor, pride, and a number of other things fall away, disappear. And in addition, when the reverberations of the broad international struggle reach your ear, all this in its entirety does its work. And the result is the complete internal moral victory of the USSR over its kneeling opponents. I'm about to finish, he says. I am perhaps speaking for the last time in my life. I am explaining how I came to realize the necessity of capitulating to the investigating authorities and to you, citizen judges. We came out against the joy of the new life with the most criminal methods of struggle. I refute the accusation of having plotted against the life of Vladimir Ilyich, that's Lenin, but my counter-revolutionary confederates and I at their head endeavored to murder Lenin's cause, which is being carried on with such tremendous success by Stalin. The logic of this struggle led us step by step into the blackest quagmire, and it has once more proved that the departure from the position of Bolshevism means siding with political counter-revolutionary banditry. Counter-revolutionary banditry has now been smashed. We have been smashed, and we repent of our frightful crimes. The point, of course, is not this repentance or my personal repentance in particular. The court can pass its verdict without it. The confession of the accused is not essential. The confession of the accused is a medieval principle of jurisprudence. A significant line. But here we also have the internal demolition of the forces of counter-revolution, and one must be a Trotsky not to lay down one's arms. I am kneeling before the country, before the party, before the whole people. The monstrousness of my crimes is immeasurable. especially in the new stage of the struggle of the USSR. May this trial be the last severe lesson. And may the might of the USSR become clear to all. Let it be clear that all that the counter-revolutionary thesis of the national limitedness of the USSR has remained suspended in the air like a wretched rag. Everybody perceives the wise leadership of the country that is ensured by Stalin. It is in the consciousness of this that I await the verdict. What matters is not the personal feelings of a repentant enemy, but the flourishing progress of the USSR and its international importance. End of speech. Let me just finish this part of the lecture with two little snippets from the New York Times. The New York Times, of course, covered the Stalin show trials, and they covered the trial of Nikolai Bukharin. How did they interpret this? Well, judge for yourself. Here is the Times, two articles from March 13th. The first, Mr. Bukharin alone, who all too obviously in his last words fully expected to die, was manly, proud, and almost defiant. He is the first of the 54 men who have faced the court in the last three treason trials who has not abased himself in the last hours of the trial, unquote. And another article, quote, in all of Mr. Bukharin's speech, there was no trace of bombast, truculence, or cheap oratory. It was a brilliant composition delivered in a matter-of-fact manner, and it was tremendously convincing. He was making his last appearance and last utterance on the world stage, where at times he has played great parts, and he seemed simply and intensely an earnest man, completely unafraid, but merely trying to get his story straight before the world, unquote. Well, it was a night session, as I said, that is the last session on March 13th, within hours, which is to say at 4:30 a.m. the next day, after a six-hour deliberation, the court pronounced their verdict and sentenced Bukharin and 17 others to be shot. 2 days later, the Soviet government announced that the sentences had been carried out. That's the end of my first trial. Fast forward now to an utterly different environment, November 21st, 1945. This is the opening address of the American chief prosecutor, Robert Jackson, at the Nuremberg trial, the trial before the International Military Tribunal of the British, the French, the Americans, and the Russians. It took place in courtroom 600 in the Palace of Justice, which you can still visit, and still visit Courtroom 600, I might add, in Nuremberg. Utterly devastated, Nuremberg. In the U.S. military occupation sector of Germany, the courtroom was packed, including a gallery which is no longer there. Otherwise, the courtroom is largely as it was in 1945. This is the Nuremberg trial. The trial actually had commenced in Berlin. Symbolically, 2 days earlier, it was assembled there at the behest of the Soviets because this was their occupation zone and they at least wanted the ceremonial opening of the trial to occur under their auspices. But then they moved to Berlin. I can't stress it enough, an utterly devastated city in which there were only a few buildings standing, one being the Palace of Justice and the other being the Grand Hotel across the street where most of the personnel of the trial actually stayed. There were 22 individual defendants. And also, this is often not widely remembered, there were also 6 Nazi organizations on trial. It's part of the American trial plan to include these organizations, which would link with subsequent judicial proceedings that would follow the trial before the International Military Tribunal. The president of the tribunal, Lord Geoffrey Lawrence of Great Britain, then called Robert Jackson, the American chief prosecutor, to address the court and make his opening statement. Robert Jackson. Robert Jackson was a distinguished American jurist. He was 53 years old at the time, born in 1892, a friend of Roosevelt, a Roosevelt supporter from the earliest days of the New Deal. He was appointed Supreme Court judge in 1941. Jackson, Supreme Court judge, actually had no law degree. He attended 1 year of Albany Law School, and he practiced for 26 years in Jamestown, New York, but interested in politics and connected with the New Deal when Roosevelt came into office. Jackson was the moving force in the negotiations that took place in London in the previous summer when the charter of the International Military Tribunal was negotiated in very difficult discussions with the French and the British, and especially the Russians. And it was the Americans, of course, who had invested the time and energy in the idea of an international military tribunal, who were the moving force behind those negotiations in London. Jackson had been there negotiating. Now he was chief prosecutor on the American team. And on November 21st, 1945, he began his address, which lasted more than 4 hours. And I want to cite to you some passages from it as a great moment in what I believe to be a great trial. And I want to offer some editorial comments as we go along, but I will be citing in extenso because I think this, unlike the very difficult, perhaps even impenetrable words of Bukharin, this is a clear statement of a particular point of view about a remarkable trial. He began, "The privilege of opening the first trial in history for crimes against the peace of the world imposes a grave responsibility. The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated. That 4 great nations, flushed with victory and stung with injury, stay the hand of vengeance and voluntarily submit their captive enemies to the judgment of the law is one of the most significant tributes that power has ever played to reason," unquote. I pause to underscore the phrase, "stay the hand of vengeance." This is actually the title of a book on international law by a Princeton writer, Gary Bass. And it underscores itself, I think, the principal alternative to the Nuremberg trials. Again, this is often not highlighted. The principal alternative was vengeance. Popular opinion polls, not only in Great Britain, but also in the United States, showed an overwhelming majority of people who preferred not a trial, but rather summary execution. And this, of course, was Stalin's basic idea, which he discussed with Churchill and Roosevelt in the Tehran Conference in 1943. Stay the hand of vengeance. Note 2, cannot be ignored. We cannot ignore these crimes, because this was the other element of the idea behind the Nuremberg trial, which was that there were only three basic options: to have a trial, or to do nothing, or perhaps to turn over all of the adjudication to the Germans themselves. Let me go on in the speech. The accused have so identified themselves with the philosophies they conceived and with the forces that they directed that any tenderness to them is a victory and an encouragement to all the evils which are attached to their names. Civilization can afford no compromise with the social forces which would gain renewed strength if we deal ambiguously or indecisively with the men in whom these forces now precariously survive, unquote. This passage refers to a fear which was palpable at the time, and I think also we tend not fully to appreciate, that there was always the great danger of a revival of Nazism. This is, of course, what had happened after the First World War. Would it happen again after the Second? And so the idea that there was a lingering sentiment in support of the evils which are attached to the names of these leaders of the Third Reich, this was an apprehension that was alive and well. The trial would have to deal with this challenge. The trial was extraordinarily ambitious. It was an effort to have an international adjudication by the four great powers that had brought the Third Reich to defeat. And Jackson says, "Never before in legal history has an effort been made to bring within the scope of a single litigation the developments of a decade covering a whole continent and involving a score of nations, countless individuals, and innumerable events. I should be the last to deny that the case may well suffer from incomplete researches and quite likely will not be the example of professional work which any of the prosecuting nations would normally wish to sponsor." Jackson is making the point here that this is an extraordinarily ambitious undertaking, and it won't be perfect. It won't be perfect. That's what he says. What about the argument that this is victor's justice, that it is the victorious powers which are unfairly presiding over a trial of the defeated leadership of the Third Reich? This brings us to the alternative, or one of the two alternatives, that the Allies faced, that the war criminals be turned over to the Germans themselves. The problem was, and Jackson refers to it now, that this had happened once before, with the end of the First World War. I quote him, "Unfortunately, the nature of these crimes is such that both the prosecution and the judgment must be by victor nations over vanquished foes. The worldwide scope of the aggressions carried out by these men have left but few alternatives and few real neutrals. Either the victors must judge the vanquished, or we must leave the defeated to judge themselves. And after the First World War, we have learned of the futility of the latter course." And so Jackson sees the trial moving ahead. I quote him again, "We must never forget that the record on which we judge these defendants today is the record on which history will judge us tomorrow. To pass these defendants a poisoned chalice is to put it to our own lips as well. We must summon such detachment and intellectual integrity to our task that the trial will commend itself to posterity as fulfilling humanity's aspiration to do justice. The American trial plan, now, let me add, was based almost entirely on documentary evidence. Jackson, we will not ask you to convict these men on the testimony of their foes. There is no count in the indictment that cannot be proved by books and records. The Germans were always meticulous record keepers, and these defendants had their share of the Teutonic passion for thoroughness in putting things on paper. We will show you their own films, you will see their own conduct, and hear their own voices as these defendants reenact for you from the screen some of the events in the course of the conspiracy. A few points here. Film. This was, I believe, the first use of film in a criminal trial, certainly on anything like this scale, and that was a revolutionary element of the Nuremberg trial. Perhaps more important, the Americans explicitly, but I think consistent with the legal culture of the day, preferred not to have witnesses. Among other reasons, they did not want to have their witnesses cross-examined by the defendants' lawyers. But they, more importantly, they wanted a record. They wanted this trial to establish a documentary basis for an understanding of the Third Reich and for what had happened during the 12 years in which Hitler was master of Germany and of a good part of Europe. What about the idea of ex post facto laws? The idea that the Nuremberg Charter was negotiated in the summer of 1945 and established the basis on which the Nazi war criminals would be charged, but that the crimes themselves were committed considerably before. Did this offend against a basic notion of justice? Jackson, that men may be protected in relying upon the law at the time they act is the reason we find laws of retrospective operation unjust. But these men cannot bring themselves within the reason of the rule which in some systems of jurisprudence prohibits ex post facto laws. They cannot show that they ever relied on international law in any state or paid it the slightest regard. And Jackson then goes on to argue that the international law of the interwar period actually did declare illegal so many of the actions of the leadership of the Third Reich, and most important for the American case, and most important for the trial, the charge of planning and preparing and launching and waging aggressive war. The common sense of men after the First World War demanded that the law's condemnation of the war reach deeper and that the law condemn not merely uncivilized ways of waging war, but also the waging in any way of uncivilized wars, wars of aggression. The world statesmen again went only as far as they were forced to go. Their efforts were timid and cautious and often less explicit than we might have hoped. But the 1920s did outlaw aggressive war. This at least was Jackson's case, and specifically the Americans referred to the Briand-Kellogg Pact of 1928, which, so he argued, outlawed aggressive war. But was there any legal authority for the Nuremberg law as governed by the Charter? What was the basis for this authority? Here, interestingly, and interestingly, I think, in our country, perhaps less understood in civil law societies, was the case that Jackson made in this speech for a common law of nations. a common law of nations. It is true that we have no judicial precedent for the Charter. But international law is more than a scholarly collection of abstract and immutable principles. It is an outgrowth of treaties and agreements between nations of accepted customs. Yet every custom has its origin in some single act, and every agreement has to be initiated by the action of some state. Unless we are prepared to abandon every principle of growth for international law, we cannot deny that our own day has the right to institute customs and to conclude agreements that will themselves become sources of a newer and strengthened international law. International law grows, as did the common law, Jackson says, through decisions reached from time to time in adapting settled principles to new considerations. And then there is the national element, the United States. The United States that had the privilege of initiating the trial, the United States in the zone of which the trial took place, the United States which was clearly by this time the only country with the infrastructure, with the research, with the communications capacities and so forth to organize a great trial with translations and with research capacities and with translations of documents and collation of documents and so forth, Jackson makes the case here for American leadership. Among the nations which united in accusing these defendants, the United States is perhaps in a position, Jackson says, to be the most dispassionate. For having sustained the least injury, it is perhaps the least animated by vengeance. Twice in my lifetime, the United States has sent its young manhood across the Atlantic, drained its resources, and burdened itself with debt to help defeat Germany. But the real home and faith that has sustained the American people in these great efforts was that the victory for ourselves and our allies would lay the basis for an ordered international relationship in Europe and would end the centuries of strife on this embattled continent. This is the idealism of Nuremberg, and I think it is interesting, whatever the subsequent failures to live up to this standard, it is important to underscore the idealism of Nuremberg and to the principle that leading statesmen and even the powers that were conducting the trial themselves would not have immunity in the subsequent years. The ultimate step, Jackson said, in avoiding periodic wars, which are inevitable in a system of international lawlessness, is to make statesmen responsible to law. And let me make it clear that while this law is first applied against German aggressors, the law includes, and if it is to serve a useful purpose, it must condemn aggression by any other nations, including those which sit here now in judgment. This trial represents mankind's desperate attempt to apply the discipline of the law to statesmen who have used their powers of state to attack the foundations of the world's peace and to commit aggression against the rights of their neighbors. The usefulness of this trial to do justice is not to be measured by considering the law or your judgment in isolation. This trial is part of a great effort to make the peace more secure. And finally, I'm at the end, a burst of idealism. The real complaining party at your bar is civilization. In all our countries, it is still a struggling and imperfect thing. It does not plead that the United States or any other country has been blameless of the conditions which made the German people easy victims to the blandishments and intimidation of the Nazi conspirators. But it points to the dreadful sequence of aggressions and crimes that I have recited. It points to the weariness of the flesh, the exhaustion of resources, and the destruction of all that was beautiful or useful in so much of the world, and to greater potentialities for destruction in the days to come. Civilization asks whether law is so laggard as to be utterly helpless to deal with crimes of this magnitude by criminals of this order of importance. It does not expect that you can make war impossible. It does expect that your juridical action will put the forces of international law, its precepts, its prohibitions, and most of all, its sanctions on the side of peace, so that men and women of goodwill in all countries may have, and here he makes a quotation, leave to live by no man's leave underneath the law. By the way, where does that quotation come from? Leave to live by no man's leave underneath the law. Anyone know? I put it in Google. The answer? Rudyard Kipling, A Poem on the Boer War, written in 1899. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.